Welcome to Soundbites on Domrapa. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. In the past year, we've brought you stories about the land, the farms, and the people of Domrapa. Throughout the year, it became clear to us that our listeners want to see the rural character of Domrapa survive. So we began to look deeper into certain questions. What will it take to keep farmers on their land? Is it possible to tend to the health of the environment and also to the needs of the people of our state and our nation? We will explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we can get there together. This week on Soundbites on Domrapa, we'll continue a conversation we've been having with local farmers for over a year and a half now, and then we'll revisit a topic we covered before the November 6th election, California's Prop 37 that would have required genetically modified foods to be labeled, and that measure was defeated by voters by a small margin. Farmers from across this region have shared their experiences and challenges with us in their quest to become a major part of the region's food and agricultural supply. This week, we bring together a diverse group of farmers from across Maryland to share what are the major impediments they face in trying to build their businesses and share their products with people from all across the region. We also wanted to hear their ideas for building a system that not only made more sense, but also that provided institutional support to farmers to go beyond the niche of community-supported agriculture, or CSAs, and farmers markets. Cleo Braber is an environmental lawyer turned farmer who's the owner of Cottingham Farm in Easton, Maryland. With her background and understanding of the complexities of the industry, I asked her what it would take to make farmers like her a mainstay as opposed to solely surviving in a niche market.
One is that what's necessary to have each of these farms independently grow, and the second is that there needs to be this integration, this integrator of the individual products of these farms. So, like, for instance, you know, what is going on in Charlottesville, the food hub over there? You know, we need to have a infrastructure. I've described it this way to you before. This is sort of like the infrastructure of the century, like the highways or the infrastructure of the 50s,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, you've got mobile processing units that go out to Ted's farm and to, you know, Denzel's farm and to Allison's farm and my farm to process animals. You know, one mobile processing unit for small animals, one for large. You have delivery cargo vans. I mean, I just bought my own, you know, Sprinter this year, and it's, you know, there should be a fleet of Sprinters and refrigerated, you know, trucks that service all of these producers. There should be a group of walk-in coolers. I had to build my own walk-in cooler. I had to build my own vegetable processing room. You know, if there's shared capital resources, joint marketing, distribution, drivers, you know, grading, sorting, shared overhead like insurance, training, you know, in short, a food aggregation system that takes these, that coordinates the plantings even, or, and integrates these smaller crops of a host of independent growers. You've got smaller producers that are creating foods, whether it's, you know, vegetables or animals or dairy products. And then there's an integrator that takes it all and coordinates production and helps to get that product labeled, packed, shipped, marketed to a host of organizations that can purchase on a larger scale, you know, institutions like schools and hospitals,
mm-hmm.
and can also sell to restaurants and CSAs and markets. There's nothing we do more often than eat, and last time I checked, we do it year-round, and we do it several times a day. So if there's an economy that can possibly be invented and fostered, you know, this is it. It doesn't take a lot to build a food infrastructure. It's an economy that's, you know, kind of waiting to be built, and it can create an awful lot of jobs within the state of Maryland, because right now we're, like most, or, you know, a mass importer of food. And we've got the capability to produce it here. We've got lots of independent farmers who want to produce it. We just need the infrastructure to support that production and distribution.
The infrastructure and the groundwork that needs to be laid for food businesses to really grow and flourish just isn't there. And how do I ever get there without, you know, tons of capital investment?
That's Denzel Mitchell, the founder and farm manager of Five Seeds Farm in Baltimore City and Baltimore County.
And so for somebody at the point where I'm at who's, you know, really new and really just getting my feet wet and really learning, you know, these conversations are extremely important, because otherwise I would probably remain at a very small and what I would think would be a very manageable scale and not ever really be able to grow my business. Like, I'd like to be able to do chickens too. So knowing those issues that blocked me from being able to do meat birds, you know, made me just take it off the list. And the state, you know, is not helpful.
That sentiment of just taking it off the list for now is shared with Allison Howard, who, with her husband Luke, owns and operates Homestead Farms in Millington, Maryland, a certified organic vegetable farm.
My husband Luke and I have done meat birds in the past, and we started out doing vegetables, chickens, and eggs, and going to markets with all of them. And as everyone has said, you know, something had to give, as Denzel said, take it off the list. And as we got bigger and more busy, the chickens and the eggs, because of regulatory measures, went by the wayside, and we just do them for our own family now.
Mm-hmm.
So we can certainly relate to what everyone has said about the distribution and the state and federal regulations of animal products coming off the farm. As we've grown larger with the vegetables, are figuring out our own distribution methods, and both my husband and I have had off-the-farm jobs, and the distribution of our products has changed over the years. We like to maintain CSA, farmers market presence, and we started out directly to restaurants, and now we've gone more of a distribution, going to Whole Foods and distributing to a number of their stores, to some of the larger wholesalers, so that kind of become the third leg of our stool, but we do try and balance it and always have the three-legged stool approach to distribution, knowing that in any one year, you know, one is certainly going to support the farm more.
The distribution method Allison described is common for sustainable farmers, but can be limiting. Outside of vegetables, there are basic roadblocks for those interested in growing and processing meat birds for consumption in our region. Ted Wycall is a third-generation farmer at Green Branch Farm in Salisbury, Maryland. He explains it from his perspective as a farmer who raises chickens and hogs and more.
There's a few things that are kind of hard to understand as a farmer that's trying to, you know, grow a farming operation. I really found this out with poultry especially, but it also deals with other, you know, our livestock, cattle, pork, and lamb. But specifically with the poultry, it's very difficult because if somebody wants to grow chickens outside of the large poultry companies, and do it independently, there really is no place that will process the chickens.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, take a live bird and turn it into something that can be consumed, you know, at home. Basically, we found that we really had to do it ourselves because there's nobody else in the area that does it. And that's a very expensive thing to get into, but, you know, it's just like any business. It's, you know, there's upfront costs. The problem that is starting to arise now is that we do a lot of our markets, farmers markets, in other states because where we are in the Delmarva, Delaware is only about 15 miles north of us and Virginia is about 30 miles south of us, so where I am here in Salisbury. So when I go to my farmers markets in other states, which is almost all of the farmers markets that we do are in Delaware, I can't take chickens with me. And even though I know I can sell a lot of chickens, it's illegal for me to cross the state line because I don't have a USDA-inspected processing facility. That might sound like, you know, why don't I get the USDA to come in and inspect my facility? Well, the problem is that I would not be able to pass their inspection, even though my facility is just fine. It's very sanitary and fine for our scale. It lacks things that are written into the law to make it approved by the USDA. Even if we want to leave the farm with the poultry, then we have a whole set of state regulations where basically we have to, every single year, get our well water tested. Even though it's already been tested for us to drink, it's the same water that we drink in our home. You know, to pass the test with flying colors, it's great. But we can't wash chickens in it without getting our well water tested every single year. It's expensive. It's a hassle. It doesn't need to be done for us to drink it, so it's kind of hard to understand why we have to do that. And then also, we have to get two licenses from the state that are renewed annually. They're not terribly expensive, but they're not cheap.
Right.
And basically, one is just to be able to store the poultry in our freezer or refrigerator. That we have to have a license to be able to do that. And we also have to have a license to transport it on a public road.
Last week on Soundbites, we talked to Red Tomato, a food hub in the Northeast, whose goal is to bring together farmers and consumers. Their distribution system doesn't revolve around a warehouse, but uses a fleet of trucks to bring farmers' products, the Red Tomato labels and packages, to supermarkets. Cleo Braver weighed in on what it might take to develop something similar in our region and why it's such an important thing for the government and the public to invest in.
You know, I think it takes $5 or $6 million, maybe less. I mean, it's just not that, it's not a big sum of money. It's what a 5 or 6 corn farmers will get in subsidies in a year. It shouldn't be daunting. It just takes the will to do it. And in the times where municipalities and state and local governments have absolutely, you know, no money to spend on new ideas. But I think it's short-sighted, because building a system like this has the capability to bring returns really quickly. I mean, if you're making healthy food accessible now in your community, you're going to have an impact on health and healthcare costs. You're going to have better health outcomes, and you're going to have lower healthcare costs. You're going to have an impact on employment. The one big, huge input of the kind of farming that all of us do is labor. You know, having labor as a high input ain't a bad thing, because it means jobs. And the environmental impact of this kind of farming that, you know, sustainable farming that we're doing is also immeasurable. And in fact, that's, you know, why I got into this in the first place, was the environmental issues. You know, and that's part of the problem. There's got to be a top-down recognition by policymakers that this is worth funding, and that there's a fairly immediate return on investment. And there's also got to be a bottom-up recognition on the part of the public, more of the public, that there is a very direct link between the food choices they make and the environment that surrounds them, their exposure to pesticides, with the, you know, increasing evidence of the, you know, the links between pesticides and a whole host of illnesses, acute and chronic. You know, the impact of this kind of conversion to this kind of food system on our wallets. I mean, you know, all I think this industry is asking for is not a whole lot of money, but transferring some of the existing subsidies to sustainable agriculture instead. You know, it's really taking money from you know, 5 or 6 larger scale corn farmers and putting it into sustainable agriculture instead. You know, the public's got to recognize that while their immediate cost of producing, you know, real food is going to be higher, you know, organic has got higher production costs. You know, grass-fed meat is 50% more expensive on that order of magnitude than grass-fed meat. But you're going to be lowering, you're going to have a better environmental impact, you're going to have lower health care costs, you're going to have better health outcomes. In the long term, it makes more sense on our wallets as well.
Denzel Mitchell.
You know, but as somebody who worked in the school system and worked with families, worked with parents, you know, that's like the second, if not third step. People need to know that from the bottom up, that people need to know that this is important, that we need this, that, and I'm not going to stand for anything less than, you know, the best food that's available. And, you know, that's an almost impossible conversation to have outside of, you know, this kind of community. Like, it's easy for the five of us to talk about it, or people who go to the farmer's market already, or the folks that shop at Whole Foods, to have that conversation is easy. But beyond that, you know, we're talking a foreign language, you know. People don't appreciate farmers, even though they eat every day, multiple times a day. You know, they don't know what farmers do. It's a really, really difficult policy to affect when, you know, the everyday people that you see really don't have any idea what you do.
Ted Wycall.
You know, we've talked about market integration, having integrators that can take it from the farms and distribute. And I think that that's going to happen. It's just that it needs time to happen. Basically, we're rebuilding this infrastructure from the ground up, and it's going to come in phases, and we're developing the first phase, which is the supply. The next phase is the integration. The only thing is that we're not able to do that as fast as we could because we're hitting the regulations. We're not allowed to transport across the state lines. We can't go regional. The other thing is that the supply is not there because there are subsidies. So people are looking at the subsidies, taking advantage of that opportunity, and they're growing things that are subsidized rather than things that are not subsidized. And so, you know, now it's a chicken and the egg thing where, you know, what do we do? What do we need to do first? What should come first? So my suggestion is that we need to look at these regulations first. Ease the regulations, so that's the government part of it. And then after that, let the private sector, let the free market, let people's ingenuity take over. Let's develop the supply and then develop the market integration.
Allison Howard.
I think that Ted's speaking to that about building supply. It is the chicken and the egg, and we've experienced that as we enter into conversations with people who are supplying grocery store chain, that we, on our farm, to build supply, which is buy more boxes, get an area to store boxes so that we can ship out product, secure a labor source so that we have consistent labor throughout the season to harvest, you know, X number of cases of kale for X number of weeks throughout the season brings in X number of dollars. And then once you start having those conversations with the distributors, and then the product starts flowing into more conventional marketing chains, because as you say, moving, you know, CSA is great. Our farm has been based on CSA for a number of years, but the math quickly points to the fact that it doesn't pay the entire mortgage. And in order to change the food system, we have to realize that not everyone has the time or the desire to join a CSA. Not everyone has the time in their schedule to get to farmers market. So we as farmers have to figure out ways to get our local products into conventional marketing chains. And as Ted said, as we grow the supply, then the demand comes from other places. We're not running into any demand issues. I would probably say any of us on this line are not running into demand issues at all, but we all run into supply issues of maintaining constant supply. So I think that Ted hit it right on when he said build the supply and let the free market figure itself out.
Denzel Mitchell.
Well, and I was going to say, you know, removing, like Cleo mentioned, removing those subsidies would, you know, allow folks like us to flourish because it levels the playing field, right? You know, like one example that I would bring up this year is working with NRCS, Soils Conservation, to cover crop my small piece of property. So it's like 3 acres, right? It cost me about $2,500 this year to cover crop it 3 times throughout the season, keep it in continuous cover crop to build the soil, to reduce erosion, deal with any nematodes that were in the soil. You know, all of these things that other farmers, big corn farmers, big soy farmers are not doing, right? So that I can grow healthy food and you know, restore the land that's been destroyed by growing commodity crops. You know, so here I'm working with this government program to do something that I would already do, and they're saying, well, we'll help you by helping you to share the cost. And their share of the cost was like $400. I spent $2,500. They gave me $400. But now a commodity grower goes and does that on 5,000 acres, and he actually makes a profit. Or, you know, on even on 50 acres, and that farmer actually makes a profit. The economies of scale are fighting against me. And, you know, nobody in government has enough sense to say, well, this small 5-acre farmer, this 10-acre farmer, you know, their subsidy needs to be a little bit more for it to make sense on his scale than for, you know, for this huge, you know, this huge corn operation.
That's a really good example.
Cleo Braver.
You know, because everything is stated in terms of per acre.
Right,
of,
exactly.
Implementing a practice. And so these huge, you know, monolithic, you know, organizations get these tremendous sums of money to do a particular practice. There's no looking at what the value is of the practice. So, for instance, somebody might get, you know, that same $60 an acre, you know, times 3,000 acres to put, you know, cover crop in, and then, you know, they'll kill the cover crop by spraying pesticides on it.
Right.
So exposing the community to 3,000 acres of pesticide application, as opposed to what Denzel's going to do, which is going to till it in to build up the tilt of the soil and increase its fertility.
Exactly.
So no look at what the value is, just how many acres did you do it on? And
right.
That is a tremendous threshold problem that needs to be addressed in the Farm Bill.
Right.
That I don't hear anybody talking about.
I asked the group about their ideas in context of the Farm Bill, which the House of Representatives failed to bring up, leaving it in a state of limbo. That action on the part of Congress essentially gives the Farm Bill 1 extra year of debate and discussion. So I asked Denzel, Allison, Cleo, and Ted what questions they want policymakers to answer and what policymakers should consider.
I mean, I think you got to deal with, like, what we learned in elementary school was a very simple concept, that equality is not giving everybody the same thing, but giving people what they need in order to be successful, in order for their business to flourish, right? You know, like, you know, Ted needs to be able to process chickens on his farm so he can sell them. and so that his business can be profitable. You cannot apply the laws that were written for these huge chicken houses and, you know, with all this lobbying money behind it, and apply it to his operation because the business model is completely different. It doesn't make sense. You can't say to a 4,000-acre corn farmer, we're going to pay you $60 an acre to plant cover crop and then burn it in the spring and not receive the value of you planting the cover crop. You're really just planting it so that you can get the money. And then say to me, we're only going to give you $60 an acre to plant cover crop on your 4 acres, and you're going to actually use the cover crop what it's meant for. Like, it doesn't make sense. We could say that to a sixth grader, and a sixth grader would say that's not fair. So, you know, that to me, that's what needs to be addressed. You know, these practices need to be applied individually based on the practices of the farm, based on the scale of the farm, based on the ideas and the philosophy of the farm. So that's one way to deal with it. Is that more complicated? Yeah, probably. But, you know, but can we deal with it? Yeah, I think so.
Allison Howard.
I think that we, as a group of sustainable farmers, I know that Luke and I really appreciate the value that our customer puts on our desire to be different and to move in a different way, and that's being certified organic vegetable farmers that are a few miles from their house, that they reward us for thinking that way by buying our product. We work hard as organic farmers to differentiate ourselves from farm bill agriculture. And my goal with this statement is certainly not to bash the farm bill or, you know, any of the folks that are receiving subsidies, because, you know, that's a whole other conversation for another day. But our customers like to buy our product because they view us as small independent growers who are kind of bucking the system and aren't relying on subsidies. You know, we also grow grain on our farm, so there are subsidies that come into our farm through organic corn and organic soybean that go to a feed mill in Pennsylvania. I strongly disagree about getting involved with getting subsidies for different types of cover crop and kind of, gosh, and I'm stumbling with the words because I really don't want to bastardize any type of agriculture, because I figure, you know, it's a hard enough road without choosing sides and things like that. But our customers are rewarding us for doing something different by buying our products. And so Luke and I feel it's very important to, number one, maintain our certification, but number two, to stay away from asking for more subsidies because we're trying to differentiate ourselves from a food system that the consumers who are trying to change our food system are relying on us to be different, I guess, is the message that I wanted to get across.
Now we hear from Cleo Braver.
One way to level the playing field is to take all the subsidies away. But, you know, it's really hard to compete because we're in a situation where all of the costs of our business are reflected in the price of our product. The cost of alternatives, or, you know, corn, high-fructose corn, I mean, the cost, the environmental and healthcare costs are not reflected in the price of those products. And on top of that, there's subsidies. But we're willing to see a world where, you know, there are no subsidies, everything's got to stand on its own, but we're getting a double whammy. You know, organic is much higher cost to produce. And, you know, and on top of that, you know, until recently, I mean, they are making strides. They are coming up with different programs to help fund small, you know, aspects of, you know, of sustainable agriculture. But it's small. So if it's only a 3,000-square-foot greenhouse that costs $25,000, you know, you get a $2,000 check to help you out. You know, it's not, it's all just based on square footage and acreage. We're happy to live in a world where there's no subsidies, and we don't have that that strike against us as well, as not having externalized costs.
Ted Wykall.
I would ask them to be fair to everybody, make it so that people can get the food that they want regardless of what state it's in. You know, let's let people vote with their dollars. Let's let them buy from their local farmers. Even if they live close to a state line, they should be able to buy from somebody that lives, you know, 15 miles away. I mean, I'm only 15 miles away from my customers, and it's illegal for me to sell to them. So that's the main thing. I mean, that is the stumbling block right there. And then if we could get rid of these ridiculous political boundaries like this, then basically it opens the entire world up to alternative farms that are growing what people want to eat.
So it's fascinating. I mean, to me anyway, to hear the four of you talking about this, and you know, it because it's because clearly, if things are going to change, that the way of subsidies and distribution systems and building the kind of as you termed it earlier, Cleo, in the conversation, kind of a food aggregation system. I mean, that's the kind of thing that has to happen for this to change.
I mean, a state line is a pretty artificial boundary. You know, it's funny, we're doing everything on such a massive scale, our current food production model, yet we can't erase a state line for the purpose of enabling local agriculture to flourish.
Because local, in one of the things I also learned in these conversations about having with folks who are trying to do things similar around the country, are that the people are thinking regionally and nationally in terms of how to feed this country, not just locally by the Delmarva, but regionally, you know, regionally around us, whether it's southern New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, Delaware. Mm-hmm. That there's a region here that we have that has lots of farms and lots of potential in it to recreate a food system.
For Delmarva, I mean, it's a pretty risk, relatively risk-free thing, because we have pretty good transportation arteries, and we are within an overnight drive of a third of the population of the country. Not that that's a good food model. I don't think anybody in this line thinks that that's a great food model. You know, food models, you know, this kind of food model wants to get smaller as it, you know, increases market share within an area. Because the smaller it is, the more, you know, the more sustainable it is and less impact. It's certainly a model that can be, you know, put on Delmarva and then replicated. We definitely have much more access to demographic centers than most parts of the country have. So it would be a fairly, you know, a relatively risk-free undertaking to invest in that kind of infrastructure here. We just need to figure out a way to supply.
We have to take a short break, but please don't go away. We have more of our conversation with farmers in Maryland about transforming the food system regionally, and our recap of the defeated ballot measure in California that would have required labeling of genetically modified foods. All that and more coming right up after this break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back to Soundbites on Delmarva, a show exploring the future of our food system. Let's jump right back into our conversation with farmers from across the state of Maryland about their ideas for fewer impediments to farmers and for transforming the regional food system.
I think, Mark, to answer your question about how we do that, there are many markets. We've done some market research with a couple of the grocery store chains on and broken it down. You know, how many acres would three giant stores, could they support?
Allison Howard.
The numbers are pretty staggering. I did some research, and there's plenty of demand, and I think what it would take is someone who is not risk-averse, start buying vegetables from people and throwing them on a refrigerated truck and meeting with the people who want to buy them. It sounds ridiculously simple. And there's a lot more to it than that, but basically it's that. It's lining up the growers and saying, okay, grower A, I want your radishes for the first 6 weeks of April and into May, and grower B, I want your broccoli from this date to that date. And it basically takes one person with a Rolodex and probably a little bit of venture capital and not real risk averse.
Ted Wykall tackles the subject of fairness.
I totally agree with that. And there's people that are doing that and doing very well, and I just think it hasn't gotten to this area yet. The supply is coming, and once it's here, then I think that's gonna happen. The other thing, I mean, that applies directly to meat as well, is that it's, you know, one of these days I'm hoping that somebody that's looking for a business opportunity is going to look around and see, oh, well, you know, there's all these livestock growers that have to wait 2 or 3 months to get into their nearest processing facility, which is 2 hours away. You know, I could service this region that's, you know, within a 2 hours drive of if I was going to build a shop, you know, I could service a region that's within a 2 hours drive of that. And people are going to realize that the livestock are there and that they need to be processed, and they'll open a shop. And, you know, that's going to solve the problem.
These ideas show the real potential the Delmarva region has to change the face of the food system regionally and locally. But the situation is very complex. While a major part of changing the food system would be to build up the infrastructure and its capability, doing so also means big changes for the way families eat and shop. And Denzel explains his position on this.
Both of those ideas are great, but, you know, again, you know, we're not dealing with what people are used to and the current paradigm. You know, people are so used to consistency. So, you know, what if grower B doesn't have, you know, he had a crop failure. There's no broccoli. You know, people are up in arms because they can't find bananas. So, you know, people have to understand that, you know, there was a hurricane and the tomato crop ended early. So no tomatoes. Deal with it. Let's, you know, it's sweet potato season. Let's eat sweet potatoes now. You know, but that's a really difficult conversation for people to have. They don't understand.
Which people are you talking about? The consumers?
The consumers. Not the farmer. You know, the farmer understands that, right?
Cleo Braver.
Well, you that's know. The other reason for integration. Because,
right.
You know, so Cleo might have lost her greenhouse with her greens in it, but, you know, Allison didn't lose hers.
Right.
You know,
right.
So there might be 12% less that week, but they're still greens.
They're still greens.
You know, that's another reason for integration, to level out the supply regularity for the Whole Foods who wants it every Tuesday and Friday, you know.
And I think that's part of all why some of the people, like the people we're interviewing in New England, have looked at this as a regional thing and not just a local thing.
Cool.
Denzel Mitchell.
And, you know, Tuscarora, you know, has presented that model, the Growers Co-op in Pennsylvania. And, I mean, it's a fantastic model. I mean, you know, they're definitely showing that it can work, you know, with just a small group of growers, just 40 growers. And, you know, they're providing food from, you know, D.C. all the way up to almost all the way up to Philly. So it can definitely work. I mean, you know, there's business opportunity here. And, you know, it just requires, you know, like somebody said, you know, people who are okay with taking a risk. But, you know, we're talking about changing communities here and essentially changing the world. You know, not trying to feed the world, but changing the way we look at food, going back to a really essential way of looking at food.
Our conversation with farmers Cleo Braver of Cottingham Farm in Easton, Denzel Mitchell of Five Seeds Farm in Baltimore City and Baltimore County, Allison Howard of Homestead Farms in Millington, Maryland, and Ted Wycall of Green Branch Farm in Salisbury. Now we turn to part two of this week's episode of Soundbites, with a recap of a story we've been following on this program for the past few months, whose outcome was just determined. Prop 37 in California, an initiative that would require genetically modified foods to be labeled. This proposition failed by a slim margin, and the California Rights No campaign, the pro-labeling side of this, was outspent 10-1. We're joined by Tom Philpott, who wrote a piece on Prop 37's outcome for Mother Jones and is co-founder of Maverick Farms North Carolina, and Charlotte Olena, field organizer with the Pesticide Action Network, who is working on the ground with the California Right to Know campaign in Southern California. So, Tom, let me just start with you. I've been reading what you've been writing in Mother Jones about this and what you've been writing about it. Talk about why you think what this says. I mean, it was pretty stunning in many ways, and the fact that I read that the NAACP in California came out against Prop 37 as well, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it was definitely an expression of grassroots power to get it on the ballot in the first place. It needed 900,000 signatures, and it got over 1 million signatures. So, you know, just right there, you've got this there was this ground game in California that got a million people to sign and get this proposition on the ballot. And, you know, as you said, it was polling, you know, something like 3-1 in support at the start of the fight. And I think it can be seen as a kind of triumph itself that just getting it on the ballot and showing this kind of support drew $45 million in industry cash into California to defeat it. $20 million of that from the big pesticide, $20-plus million, I think, from the big pesticide groups that benefit from sort of unlabeled GMOs. And I think just that right there is a kind of triumph. I mean, it showed that these grassroots groups in California that were organizing this were doing something that was really against the interests of these companies. And they came out in full force. They hired incredibly slick advertising groups in California and political operatives, including this one guy who worked, had been an attorney for the tobacco industry for a while, and led the fight against Gray Davis that got Governor Schwarzenegger elected. So, you know, extremely heavy hitters in California politics. And I think when you look at it from that perspective, it isn't that surprising that it was defeated. And I think that, you know, the way to think about it is a stepping stone, a learning experience. You know, electoral politics is a different arena than most grassroots activists are used to working in. In a high-stakes campaign like this one, in a big, powerful state like California. And I think that, you know, in the end, it's got to be seen as a really amazing learning experience and this indicator that labeling is something that is critical. You know, there is this necessity for us to know what's going into our food. There's a right to know. And the industry clearly does not want that information to be out.
So let me talk about what your experience was on the ground then, Charlotte, as an organizer around this.
I think I definitely agree with a lot that Tom said. But I think the biggest thing is that we, you know, going into this, we always knew we were going to be outspent. We knew that, you know, the big guys, the big pesticide companies were, and junk food companies as well, you know, were going to be pouring this kind of money into the opposition. And I think that the grassroots movement itself was, you know, had enough bodies behind it and had enough people in support of Prop 37. I think we could have battled, you know, that money pretty effectively if we had had the kind of support for the volunteers and direction for the volunteers that's necessary in, you know, an electoral campaign. And I think what Tom said about, you know, this being kind of a learning experience and the electoral politics game being different, you know, than what most grassroots volunteers are used to, I think that's definitely true. From working with the volunteers here on the ground, there's so much passion behind them. And, you know, a lot of people who really deeply believed in this proposition and really care about this. And, you know, I think had they had the right direction about what to do in an electoral campaign in terms of voter contact and, you know, not just pure visibility events, I think we could have won this campaign. And I think one of the big problems was that we tried to go, you know, toe-to-toe with these big pesticide corporations, you know, who we knew were going to outspend us on advertising and who we knew were going to play dirty. And why. And, you know, all the opposition had to do was cast doubt on the proposition. They didn't have to, you know, convince people that labeling GMOs was a terrible idea. They had to convince people that the language of the law, you know, was maybe, you know, less than ideal. So in terms of the advertising game, the campaign paid, you know, all of their money into advertising, and it was kind of too little too late to be able to stand up to the kind of big guns that the opposition brought. And so I think that something that is hopeful about Prop 37 is that there was a huge grassroots movement behind it. I just don't think it was effective as it could have been.
So let me throw some things back at you, just kind of looking at thinking this thing through. I mean, mm-hmm. one is that they did throw a lot of money at this, and the folks who were for Proposition 37 were really outspent by the Monsantos and by other large companies that that supply a lot of cereal to people's breakfast tables, and many of those that, like Kashi, that are now owned by, I think, General Mills, if I'm right, one of them, that do use GMOs. But in this election, money was thrown around all over the place. Huge money was spent by super PACs in the campaign, Romney's campaign especially, and also Obama's campaign, but especially Romney's campaign. Despite the money being spent, there was a Obama won, and Democrats won more than they thought they would. So I wonder if we can, what that says about putting the blame on the money. Not that it's not a straw man, but I mean, if there's more to it than just the money.
I definitely think so, and I think that's a really, speaking about the Obama campaign, I think it's a really good example. You know, Obama was a community organizer. That was a really well-run campaign and one that made big use of volunteers and voter contact. Also registered a lot of new voters and did a great job at turning out youth votes and the Latino vote as well. And so, I think that's a really good example of how, you know, something well-run, you know, with good, clear directives for volunteers and a big volunteer force working on voter contact, working on getting out the vote, you know, can stand up to that money. And I think, you know, if we look at 37 in California, I mean, they had to pay $45 million to get a 3% majority. So, you know, it was pretty close. You know, it could have been way worse. And that's part of the reason that I really feel, you know, that it's not all about the money, because we always knew we were going to get outspent like that. You know, if the whole thing had been capped at $10 million, you know, we would have had it in the bag. But I think, you know, if the campaign had been more focused on voter contact and more organized, you know, with some clear directives of how to talk to voters and how to get in touch with them and how to, you know, turn out the vote, I think we would have done a better job at combating, you know, the ads that were coming out with personal interactions with people, and that just didn't really happen on a large scale.
Tom, how do you respond to that?
I think that sounds exactly right. I think that, you know, from what I've heard, that's pretty consistent. At the same time, it doesn't really surprise me that some tactical errors were made, because, you know, this is, you get one shot at this. This was a kind of a coalition that came together pretty quickly. You know, they did have a decent amount of money. The committee, you know, the pro Prop 37 forces, Charlotte, how much did they raise? It was something like $8 or $9 million. And in the early parts of the campaign, they actually were able to outraise the other side before the big money started to roll in. And so they had decisions to make. You know, these are the resources that we have here. They're not tiny, but, you know, they are, you know, by some, you know, they're essentially what, there was a Proposition 2 in California in a couple of years ago. I forget exactly what year it was. I think it was 2009, where there was a proposition to ban battery cages for hens in egg laying operations. You know, so once again, this sort of grassroots food reform going up against the big industry. And in that race, the pro-Proposition 2 forces raised about the same amount of money, which is $8 million. The opposition only raised $10 million, so they, you know, they were barely outspent. But the point is, they had about the same amount to work with. But, you know, these are interesting new challenges for the food movement. And, you know, it doesn't surprise me that tactical mistakes were made. One thing that struck me from the outside was that there didn't seem to be a good organized effort to combat the distortions and lies that were coming out of the opposition. And I was seeing on Twitter just before and after the election, people saying, well, this is a very badly written, you know, I'm in favor of labeling GMOs, but this is very badly written. And that was complete industry talking point. And my understanding of it was that the language was based on the European labeling requirement. And the idea was, let's sort of put California in sort of sync with the European Union. And, you know, all the stuff about exemptions and all that stuff was just crazy and wrong. The idea that it was going to cost, you know, whatever it was, $500 a year to the consumer, that was wrong. And those things resonated with voters, and I think a lot of voters voted against Proposition 37 based on them. You know, Charlotte, I'd like to get your perspective. Do you think there was a good effort at the grassroots voter level to address those concerns?
Yeah, I mean, not really. I mean, like I said, you know, there just wasn't enough focus on voter contact at the grassroots level. There was no direction from, you know, California Right to Know or the Labeled GMOs group to say, you know, let's phone bank, let's talk to people and, you know, be able to address these concerns that people had. And so, no, I mean, there was never really a strong answer to that. The group that I was working with in Ventura County, I mean, we did our best to combat those arguments, you know, by engaging people in conversation and getting those cleared up in the media when we could. But it was really too little too late. And the lack of an organized response from the campaign, I think, definitely didn't help it. I mean, when we finally started running our ads, there was no response to all of the lies that the opposition had been spreading. And that, you know, all of that just went completely unanswered. And the opposition was really able to shift the dialogue completely. You know, we kind of lost control of the messaging on the campaign. And so, yeah, I mean, that definitely didn't help.
Well, I wonder if part of it might be that some of the stuff I was watching as this unfolded, and we've been covering it with different people over the last several months, is that most people, some people were worried about the cost, and that was one of the big things that was pushed, which may be that, and corporate funding might be part of why the statewide NAACP and other groups came out against it. Was the issue of cost. And I think that there are a lot of people who think that GMOs may be the only way of feeding the world inexpensively, and that they don't feel like the people who are involved in what we call the food movement, which is kind of very amorphous, really have an idea of how you can transform a food system to take care of people's needs. Could that have all played into this as well?
One thing, I'm not an expert on California politics, but I have noticed in a lot of campaigns, the NAACP and a lot of the other sort of civil rights groups will take positions like that. Like all those same groups came out against Proposition 2, the proposition about banning battery cages. And I think there's something else besides just those groups deciding that this is not in the interest of African Americans or Hispanics. I mean, I think there's also money in play in those kinds of decisions and coalition building, you know, between chambers of commerce and NAACP and all of that. But having said that, yeah, I mean, I think you're right that saying that it's going to cost families $500 more per year in additional costs. There is this idea out there that the food movement is elitist, doesn't have practical ideas for, you know, how to feed people in an affordable way, and here they've cooked up this other scheme that's going to cost me $500 a year, but what's the benefit going to be? And I think some of the fault of that lies with the movement. There have been, you know, particularly in California, there are parts of the movement in the past that have said things that, like, people should pay more for their food, people aren't paying enough for their food, which in some senses is true, but you can't say that without looking at the broader economic system. And if you're a low-income person, and I remember specifically, this was in the big economic meltdowns of 2007, 2008, when people were really struggling, unemployment was surging,
yep,
and food prices were surging at the same time because of ethanol and other things that were going on. And I remember reading articles from prominent California-based food movement people saying, hey, this is great. People are finally paying more for their food. And I actually wrote something about what a wrong message that was when people are struggling and you're telling them that they're not paying enough for their food and they need to pay more. And, you know, if you're not able to put enough food on your table, that is a message that is going to completely alienate you. And I think the movement has gotten beyond some of that rhetoric, but, you know, it's there. And I think it's easily exploitable by corporations where these, you know, these big, essentially elite corporations, instead, these corporations that are extremely profitable, that have a huge degree of control over the food system, can say, hey, our critics are elitist. We're the ones that are bringing you cheap food, even though they're the ones that are like sort of bottling up all the profits in the food system, underpaying workers, squeezing farmers, contributing to this economic system that we have with stagnating wages, and they're able to present themselves as sort of the populist, bringing food to the masses kinds of organization. And that's something that the food movement really has to figure out how to get around, because those corporations, those are the elite. Those are the people that are making money, squeezing profits out of the food system, and delivering an inferior product in exchange, and squeezing labor all up and down the chain.
So finally, because we only have a few seconds left here, and Charlotte, I'm just curious where you and the movement that you've been involved in California take this now.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot to be done still. I think there hasn't been a whole lot of official direction from anybody at the moment in California, so a lot of people are kind of splitting into different directions. Some people are working to try and get labeling, like, nationally. I've seen, you know, people trying to get on board with the labeling initiative in Washington State. Some people have, you know, taken to kind of some, you know, guerrilla labeling tactics with, like, label it yourself, which I think, as far as I can tell, just involves, you know, people putting stickers on things in grocery stores. Pesticide Action Network has shifted the focus to stopping the new GE crops that are up for approval by the USDA. So we'll be working to launch some popular support in California amongst consumers and farmers to try and pressure the USDA to not approve the applications for these new genetically engineered crops that are designed to be resistant to some really crazy hazardous pesticides. The dialogue is shifting in kind of a lot of different ways, but I think the great thing is that I definitely think, you know, there is a grassroots movement for the food movement now, and, you know, while it's young and there's a lot of learning to be done across the movement, I think Prop 37 has really showed that, you know, that support is there, and there are a lot of people who think that something needs to change, which I think is great and pretty inspiring.
That was Tom Philpott, writer for Mother Jones Magazine, and Charlotte Elena, field organizer for the Pesticide Action Network. And I'd like to thank all of our guests today for joining us. Cleo Braver, Denzel Mitchell, Allison Howard, Ted Wycall, Tom Philpott, and Charlotte Elena. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our senior producer is Justin Levy. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, where their Maryland Mortgage Program can help in the purchase of a new home. To honor the Veterans Day holiday in November, active military members and veterans should know about the Maryland Homefront Mortgage Program. Former and current service members who are in the market for a new home can take advantage of a discounted interest rate mortgage and down payment and closing cost assistance. To learn more, please visit mmprogram.org or call 800-638-7771 for the Maryland Homefront Mortgage Program.